It's the NPR News Update. I'm Phil Picardi with the Minnesota News Podcast for Monday, 4 de Mayo. Coming up, state poultry farmers wonder if they can hang on. State lawmakers begin the nitty-gritty phase. Who are the key players in St. Paul? And Osmo Venska talks about the Minnesota Orchestra and its upcoming trip to Cuba. First, Nakima Levy-Pounds is the new president of the Minneapolis NAACP. Levy-Pounds, who has a leadership role in Black Lives Matter Minneapolis, ran unopposed in the election. The University of St. Thomas law professor says she hopes to bring younger engagement in the local branch of the nation's oldest civil rights organization.
I see this as an opportunity to rebirth the Minneapolis chapter of the NAACP, to bring some fresh energy to the group, to help revitalize the organization, to help mobilize the community, and to engage stakeholders.
The chapter's departing president, Jerry McAfee, had said he did not think Levy-Pounds was the best candidate for the job. He said she's focused on police brutality, but she hasn't been a strong voice on other community issues. A writing and English teacher from St. Paul is the 2015 Minnesota Teacher of the Year. Amy Hewitt Olatunde teaches at Leap High School in St. Paul, where she works with an all-immigrant student population.
Every day is wonderful with every single one of my kids. They're just excited to be in the classroom. A lot of them come from backgrounds where they weren't given the opportunity to go to school. I try to make lessons that are going to be engaging and rigorous, but also fun for the kids.
On top of teaching at LEAP and pursuing her own education, Hewitt Olatunde is also an adjunct professor at Hamline University and the University of St. Thomas. The award is sponsored by the Teachers Union, Education Minnesota. Minnesota poultry farmers are experiencing the crisis of a lifetime. Avian influenza has decimated turkey and chicken flocks, with almost 4 million birds lost to the disease. Since the outbreak began in March, the virus has inflicted a financial and emotional toll on farmers. They're wondering if they can survive. Reporter Mark Stile introduces us to one of them.
Standing near one of his barns that was infected by avian flu in Meeker County, lifelong turkey producer Greg Langmull can only shake his head in amazement at the damage the disease has caused.
This is just completely mind-blowing. I mean, I just can't believe the devastation that this disease has plowed through Minnesota with.
For poultry producers like Langmo, avian flu is the worst disease outbreak they've ever seen. In 2 months, the virus has hit farms from the Iowa border to near Canada. The H5N2 virus has cost farmers millions of dollars in losses. Langmo lives in hard-hit central Minnesota, where dozens of flocks have been struck down. Farmers are keeping almost constant watch over their birds, supporting each other, and wondering which farm will be next.
I'm texting some guys at 3:30 and 4 in the morning, and they're in the barns or in the offices, and nobody's sleeping. I mean, you go to sleep out of sheer exhaustion, and the moment you wake up, your mind starts and you're done.
Despite his best efforts to keep his turkeys healthy, Langmo's initial luck in avoiding the flu ran out in mid-April.
The manager called and said, they just don't look right.
The barn in question is just 100 yards or so from where Langmo is standing. Visitors are not allowed inside the building. When he got there after the disease was first reported, he saw right away that the 11,000 turkeys in the facility were sick. Only a few had died, but the rest were acting like they might be the next to go.
In the morning, there's always a lot of chattering and running and flying and jumping, and there was none of that. Just complete silence.
Tests confirmed that the flock had the H5N2 virus. Within 4 days, the disease had killed nearly all his birds. Turkeys in two other barns on this site were killed as a preventive measure. It was a difficult thing to take emotionally because Langmo and his workers pride themselves on keeping the flocks healthy. The financial fallout was just as harsh. Langmo says he hasn't calculated his loss, but says it likely will be at least $100,000, but probably a lot more. He says he's not sure if this decades-old turkey farm will be able to keep going.
We're sitting here watching the equity that we've built in this business over the last 50 years, 60 years, get flushed down the toilet, and pretty tough to survive.
It will be months before he can put turkeys back in the affected barns. That lost production will reduce the year's expected revenue even more. State and federal regulators must recertify the barns for production before turkeys can be restocked in the buildings. Langmuir says there should be more federal or state help available than what's being offered now to help producers through the financial turmoil of the bird flu.
I've told each of my staff independently that we're going to spend everything we got in the checkbook and then we're done, but we're not going to quit until we're broke. It's damn serious.
What began as a single outbreak in Pope County in early March has grown into a battle of survival for the state's turkey industry, with no end in sight. Langmuir and the rest just hope the disease will back off and give them some time to regroup, financially and emotionally. Mark Stile, Minnesota Public Radio News, Meeker County.
The Minnesota Senate is expected to vote on its tax bill today. Kathy Werzer talked about the week ahead at the state capitol with reporter Tim Pugmeyer.
All right, let's talk about that Senate tax bill. What's in that bill?
Right. This is a $460 million bill, about $200 million in direct property tax relief, about a tenth of what House Republicans have in their $2 billion package of tax cuts. The Senate bill has tax breaks for businesses that hire veterans, tax breaks to encourage workforce housing development in rural areas. There's an increase in state aid to cities and counties with the hope that that will hold down local property taxes. Senate Democrats have called it balanced and cautious, but Republicans say it's inadequate given the $1.9 billion budget surplus. So there are some big differences ahead facing House and Senate negotiators.
There is this big gap between the House and Senate bills. Does a tax bill need to get passed this year?
Well, that's an option that DFL Senate Majority Leader Tom Bach has suggested several times. He says lawmakers are required to pass a budget but not required to pass a tax bill. Current tax law would still be in place if they did not. But really, this is about negotiations. Bach has said that the tax bill is a way to ensure that there's also a transportation bill this session. He's offered a dollar-for-dollar trade of tax cuts for a gas tax increase to House Republicans. House Speaker Kurt Dowd said that he doesn't think skipping a tax bill would be anyone's preference, and he said he'd shudder to think what the budget surplus would look like if they made no tax reductions this session.
What was the response to the dollar-for-dollar deal?
They have not taken that offer as of now. As you know, House Republicans very much opposed to any gas tax increase.
How far apart are some of the other big budget bills?
Well, there are big differences in just about every one. The state government finance bills might have the most differences, and that conference committee met Friday for the first time to start comparing the bills. But big differences also in the transportation bills, health and human services, and education bills. The transportation and HHS conference committees will start working on Tuesday. Senate Democrats actually are relatively close to Governor Dayton on spending, but there are some key differences there, too, because the Senate did not include the governor's universal preschool plan in its education bill, and the Senate also left out his child care tax credit expansion in the tax bill.
Because there are such wide differences of opinion, there's a lot of money at stake here, obviously, and some wide political philosophy differences here. I'm wondering, what's the talk about a potential special session, not finishing on time and going into special session?
Well, we've been hearing a lot from the governor and Senator Bach about concerns about the policy provisions in these House budget bills, and they're suggesting that those issues could slow the negotiations. Speaker Dowd has said that policy provisions are always part of finance bills and the conference committees will just have to deal with them. He also suggested that the House and Senate could test the governor's veto resolve by sending him some budget bills that he might not be comfortable with. Senator Bach said that would be unproductive, and Governor Dayton said he's not backing down on his priorities for the session, and he'll still be there after the constitutional adjournment date if necessary.
All right. Tim Pugmire, have a good week.
Thanks, Kathy.
Kathy Werzer and Tim Pugmire on Morning Edition. Well, it will be up to the leaders of the House and the Senate and the governor to find agreement on the issues shaping the legislative session. On Friday, Tom Scheck looked at the players, DFL Senate Majority Leader Tom Bach, Republican House Speaker Kurt Dowd, and DFL Governor Mark Dayton.
You'd think it would be easy to reach a budget deal when the state has a $1.9 billion surplus. But the pot of money is so big and the political philosophies are so different that a way out seems hard to find. And whatever deal is cut could mean major changes for education, health care, tax policy, and transportation.
There's no question that, at least in terms of actual dollars, we're as far apart as I've ever seen.
DFL Senator Dick Cohen is the longtime chair of the Senate Finance Committee. He's served in the legislature since 1976, so he's been through plenty of budget battles. But these disagreements are new. House Republicans are proposing a $2 billion tax cut, eliminating the popular Minnesota Care health insurance program and just a small increase in school funding. Senate Democrats want a smaller tax cut and more spending for all areas of the budget. Governor Dayton proposed the smallest tax cut of the three and wants more money for early childhood education, schools, colleges, and universities. Cohen said, for a deal to work, all three sides need to walk away with something.
It's a three-cornered negotiation, and it's not, you know, everybody gets their way all the time. It doesn't work that way. It never has, never should.
Each of the three main budget players is staking out his position. Governor Dayton is looking to build on his legacy in his final term in office. He's drawn a line on universal pre-kindergarten for four-year-olds and on improving water quality by requiring farmers to leave buffer strips near lakes, streams, and rivers.
I'm not going to back down on the things that I've identified and will continue to identify as absolutely essential for me to have and absolutely essential for Minnesota not to have. And I'll be here for as long as it takes to achieve that.
Republican House Speaker Kurt Dowd is coming from a different perspective. The former car salesman has to make his pitch to skeptical Democrats that state government should shrink when there's a budget surplus and that the extra money should be used to cut taxes. On top of that, in order to end the session on time, Dowd may have to sell a budget deal that doesn't include those priorities to a conservative caucus. And like any car dealer, Dowd has to set a walk-away price from Dayton.
I told him that I thought his budgets were just about as far off target as ours. So I hope the governor's willing to move. If he's not willing to move, we're going to have trouble.
DFL Senate Majority Leader Tom Bach is a union negotiator who fancies himself a master dealmaker. Outside of the Capitol, Bach spends much of his time hunting and fishing, two hobbies that require lots of patience. Bach signaled he's willing to wait out the speaker on taxes.
He says, well, I have to have a tax bill. And I said, well, you know, I really want to get a transportation bill. And he said a second time, well, I have to have a tax bill. And I said, you know, I'm willing to consider matching you dollar for dollar. For every dollar of gas tax money he's willing to give me in that bill, I'm willing to give him a dollar of tax relief.
Republicans have repeatedly said they won't support a higher gas tax for transportation projects. But Republican House Tax Chair Greg Davids of Preston said he also knows $2 billion is not likely to be the size of a final tax cut.
I'm working on some scenarios. What if it's $1 billion? What if it's $500 million? What if it's $400 million? What are the priorities of the House?
Lawmakers have until May 18th to reach a budget agreement. If they don't, the governor will be forced to call lawmakers back into a special session. 4 years ago, a standoff over the budget between Dayton and Republican legislative leaders forced a partial government shutdown. At the start of this session, all sides said that wouldn't happen again, but now with the clock ticking, no one is ruling it out. Tom Scheck, Minnesota Public Radio News, at the Capitol.
Later this month, the Minnesota Orchestra goes on tour to Cuba. They will be the first American orchestra to perform there since the Obama administration began the process of normalizing relations with the country. It will not be the first time the orchestra has played in Cuba. It was the site of the first tour by the Minneapolis Symphony Orchestra outside the U.S. in 1929 and again in 1930. The Minnesota Orchestra's music director, Osmo Venska, talked with Tom Cran on Friday.
So this tour to Cuba is happening very quickly by orchestral standards. Usually you're planning a couple of seasons in advance, right? Did you have any concerns at all before you agreed to it that I have to make sure that the orchestra's playing up to the standards you want them to be on the international stage?
No, absolutely no, because since we started again after the lockout, the quality of the orchestra, it has been really, really, really great and so high that everybody, including me, well, we all are surprised about. So the orchestra is doing really well, and I think that we are ready to take any challenge in the world. We can go wherever.
Why is this trip to Cuba specifically so important for the Minnesota Orchestra?
Well, if you think about all the news during last 2 years about the Minnesota Orchestra, I think that we have heard so many bad news, so many dark-sided news about the lockout and all those kind of things which were included. So I think that the news about the new trip to Cuba with the Minnesota Orchestra, it might be the best possible chance for us to show to the music business that we are back and we are playing really well and we are going to be the ambassadors going to Havana and playing as the first North American orchestra since President Obama changed the rules.
Back in 1959, I found this quote from Leonard Bernstein about diplomacy and music. There's the artistic aspect of this, and then there's the diplomatic aspect as well. And Leonard Bernstein said in 1959, music costs so much less and produces so much a better result than any propaganda or weaponry. There are no warmer feelings than those engendered by music. Is that part of this as a diplomatic mission as well for the Minnesota Orchestra?
Yes, absolutely. It is. It's one part of that. And I have to say that Bernstein said it so well. Someone else has said that when the leaders of different countries, when they are planning to start a war, it might be a good idea to put them into the concert hall and lock the doors and put them to listen to Brahms' symphony or something like that.
And what would that do, do you think?
Well, it couldn't do anything worse than I think that what the idea behind of that is that there are some directions, there are some other words than those which we are seeing, and I think that if we give music a chance to take care of us, it could heal many bad things, and it could make some new ideas, and it could even make some new minds, and people might be able to come out from their holes and corners where they have locked themselves.
When we sat down to talk, I realized it's been just about a year since you returned as music director of the Minnesota Orchestra after the lockout and your resignation during that period. So I want a bit of a report card here, a status check. And that is, at the time, in an interview with NPR, you said, "We want to go to the level where it was before the lockout started." Would you say that the orchestra is back to that level?
I would say, yes, it is back to that level. And I think that it's not going to stop at that level. I have a feeling that there is such kind of united vision about what we are willing to do, and the orchestra is playing really well, and we are going to show to everybody that it's a great orchestra, and it's time to forget all the bad things which have happened, and let's just think all the possibilities in future.
And as far as you know, it is the organization at a healthy level for sustaining the future, whether it's financially or administratively.
Yeah, I'm just coming here from a meeting which was very, very positive between some board members, some musicians, and administrative stuff. So I think that there is a fresh new sense of how to do things in future. And we are all working. We are going to the same direction. And I would like to say that the new thing which we have about planning, when the players are much more involved than they have been earlier, so it's giving us great results. We have great programs and great ideas about the future. I want to say that the orchestra is doing very, very strongly, and the atmosphere of the organization is healthier than it has been.
How important is it that musicians are involved in that planning that you were talking about, the planning of the artistic planning, but also, I imagine, other ways as well with the future of the orchestra?
Yes, I think that it's extremely important that the players are taking care of their own future, because that's the way how everybody is more committed. That's the way how everybody is thinking about how can we do better, how can we do better, and a lot of new ideas are on the table, and I think that that's making the orchestra much stronger.
Is it too early to talk about your future with the orchestra beyond, what, one more year on your contract extension? Are you happy enough with the way things are going that you can see being here for longer than that?
It's a little bit too early to speak about that.
Is it?
Today.
Okay. As you look back on this, and no one would want to go through this lockout again, but a year later, what do you think you've learned and the orchestra has learned to move forward here, to be in a place that a lot of people might not have predicted from what you're saying now, a year later?
Mm. I think that there is always a chance to learn something, even from the very bad things which have happened. There is a way to learn something and try to find a new way of thinking, and try to avoid those situations which led us to the very bad result. And I think that we all have learned a lot of things.
I think we'll leave it there and wish you all the best with the tour to Cuba.
Thank
you. Listening.
Thank you very much. It's a great opportunity, and I know that the concerts are going to be something really exceptional.
Maestro Fenske, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Osmo Venska and Tom Cran on All Things Considered. And that's the NPR News Update podcast for Monday, May 4. I'm Phil Picardi, back with Minnesota's news on your schedule tomorrow.